From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Floating format for you tonight with open lines during the last hour of the program. While all across the Twin Cities in Minnesota, in Spanish, Greek, English, prayers rose up Sunday. Prayers of peace for grieving families, prayers of strength for those still searching the Mississippi River, and prayers of gratitude from those who were spared. At least five people were killed and about 100 injured when the concrete and steel span abruptly gave way in rush hour traffic last week, sending dozens of vehicles and dozens of debris into the river. This weekend, I ran into actually two people who had not even heard of the story yet. And I found that unbelievable, but it's true. In Goose Creek, South Carolina, two men have been detained after police found a very suspicious item in their car during a routine traffic stop near Charleston. Then the police detonated it. The men, who had been stopped for speeding, were being held pending a charge of unlawful possession of an explosive device. Goose Creek is home to the Naval Weapons Station, which houses the U.S. Naval Consolidated Brig, which is a military prison where enemy combatants have been held. A terrorism task force is reviewing the evidence. In Noble, Oklahoma, a very sad story there. A stray bullet fired by a police officer trying to shoot a snake hit and killed a five-year-old boy fishing at a nearby pond. Austin Healy was fishing with his grandfather when the grandfather said he heard a shot and saw a bullet hit the water just a few feet in front of the boat dock where he was standing. Moments later, a second shot was fired that hit little Austin in the head. A police officer who had been responding to a report of a snake in a tree apparently fired the deadly shot while trying to kill the snake. 78-year-old Lee Hazelwood died in Las Vegas peacefully of cancer. An icon, an American country singer, songwriter, and record producer. Bill Tuttle, a makeup artist who transformed Tony Randall into all seven title characters of Seven Faces of Dr. Law, worked on also The Wizard of Oz and created the monstrous Morlocks in the 1960s Time Machine. He has died, 95 years old. Tuttle, who had a 35-year career at MGM, was the first person to receive an Academy Award for makeup work when he received an honorary Oscar at the 1965 ceremony for Lau. Tuttle also turned Peter Boyle into a monster in the Mel Brooks 1974 comedy Young Frankenstein, and also worked on a dozen episodes of television's The Twilight Zone, including the classics Eye of the Beholder and Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. The grandniece of Nikola Tesla, Ariel Louise, a proponent of new energy and new thinking, she was involved with several internet radio programs, has passed away. The circumstances of her death still unknown, but they do think that perhaps high temperatures in her unair-conditioned mobile home might have been the cause. She was a great lady. Tibet's living Buddhas, listen to this story, have been banned from reincarnating without permission from China's atheist leaders. The ban is included in new rules intended to assert Beijing's authority over Tibet's Buddhist people. The so-called reincarnated living Buddha without government approval is illegal and invalid, according to the order, which comes into effect on September 1st. A robotic dirt and ice digger blasted off Saturday morning right after we got off the air Friday into Saturday morning on a 422 million mile journey to Mars that NASA hopes will culminate next spring in the first landing within the Red Planet's Arctic Circle. The Delta II rocket carrying the Phoenix Mars lander rose from its seaside pad at 5:26 a.m. in the morning, exactly on time, Eastern time, and hurtled through the clear moonlight sky. It was easily visible for 5 minutes with a bright orange speck and a spray of stars. If all goes as planned, but that's an if, considering that only five of the world's 15 attempts to land on Mars have succeeded, the spacecraft will set down on the Martian Arctic plains on May 25th of 2008. It will then spend 3 months scraping up soil and ice, analyzing the samples for past or present life. Listen to this one. The Department of Defense is planning to implant microchips in soldiers' brains for monitoring their health information and has already awarded a $1.6 million contract to the Center for Bioelectronics, Biosensors, and Biochips at Clemson University for the development of an implantable biochip. Soldiers fear that the biochip, about the size of a grain of rice, which measures and relays information on soldiers' vital signs 24 hours a day, can be used to put them under surveillance even when they are off duty. Incredible story. The seemingly boundless internet is running out of a key resource, new IP addresses. IP addresses, which are somewhat like telephone numbers, allow machines in homes and offices to locate and communicate with one another over the global network. The evaporating supply of new addresses, which some estimates say could dry up in about 3 years, could drive up the price of internet access as well as disrupt the growth and performance of the network, according to some experts. Up next, a very special guest, Stan Tenen, as we talk about quantum computing, intelligent design, and much more on Coast to Coast AM. Stan Tenen is the Director of Research for the Miru Foundation with a Bachelor of Science in Physics from Brooklyn Polytechnic Institute. Mr. Tenen has designed and produced optical and electronic equipment for doctors, surgeons. He holds several patents in 1968. While examining the Hebrew text of Genesis, he noticed what appeared to be a pattern in the arrangement of those letters. This observation, which prompted 30 years of research into the history and mythology of the text, has led to also a meaningful understanding of traditional teachings. We'll take some time tonight to talk with Stan about that, because it is indeed an incredible story. Back on Coast to Coast, Stan Tenen. Hey, Stan, how are you?
Fine.
Good to have you with us. What's new?
Well, many things are new. First, I caught you on the Larry King Show, rebroadcast on Sunday on the UFO panel.
There I was.
Bravo. Thank you. Excellent.
Popped in, popped out.
I didn't know you interviewed Stanton Friedman.
Oh, many times. As a matter of fact, he was
my
first when I was a kid. Yeah, 21 years old.
Good old. Kudos.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Hey, you know, I'm just learning the modern computer world, and then when I found out you're going to be on and we're going to do some talking about quantum computers, I said, my gosh, now I got to study this one. This is a difficult system. It's not even really ready yet, is it?
Not quite, but we know the principles, and there have been experiments, and the concepts have been proven. And they're not that hard to understand. What they are is hard to believe. The ideas, as we're going to see, were deduced from observation of nature in the ancient world. So even though they seem like very modern, very mysterious and high-tech ideas, these are not ideas that were beyond other people's understanding in the ancient world. But the problem is, with quantum mechanics, when you do think you understand it, you're even more astonished when you don't think you understand it, or when you think you don't understand it.
That's when it changes again.
Let me set the stage with the most ridiculous of all impossible discussions. And everyone's heard of Schrodinger's cat, but this makes the point in the starkest possible way.
Okay.
Schrodinger's cat is an experiment where there's no cats have been harmed to do the experiment. This is done in other ways.
Right.
But the easiest way to understand is you have a cat, and the cat's in a box, and in the box there's a radioactive source that statistically is going to emit an electron, a gamma ray, whatever, sometime in the next 20 days. And at random, you open the box, and at any given time, you can't tell until you open the box whether that gamma ray has been emitted. And if it's emitted, it releases some mechanism that kills the cat. So the cat is either dead or alive, and until you look in the box, you can't tell.
You don't know.
Not only don't you know, but in a strange way, quantum mechanics says the cat could be both dead and alive, or dead and or alive. And so the following can be true. Now, again, no one has done anything with real cats.
But again,
with this experiment in the lab with subatomic particles and optical devices. What you do is you have, to make it simple, you have the cat in the box covered on the lab bench in the laboratory, and in walks the first experimenter, and he closes the door behind him. And he lifts the box, and oh, terrible, the cat is dead. But even worse, at that moment, the observer that the cat was dead has a heart attack, God forbid, and falls to the ground, passes away. And the box falls back over the dead cat. The next guy walks into the room, closes the door, sees his buddy on the ground, says, oh, this is terrible, tries to revive him, whatever, it doesn't happen, the guy is permanently gone. And then he lifts the box. He doesn't know what the first guy observed.
Right.
The observer is gone. The cat has gone back, even though the first guy we now think saw it was dead, we can't really know, because the observer is gone. The cat is still in quantum mechanical superposition, which means it's possible the second guy lifts the box, the cat's alive.
See, and that's what I find confusing.
No, hard to believe. You understood what I said.
It's just hard to follow. It's hard to comprehend because we are used to, as conventional computers work, information simply stored on a bit. It either is or it isn't.
Well, we have new kinds of bits. They're called qubits, quantum bits, and they behave differently. They're not yes, no. They're maybe, 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 until you look, we can't tell. And if you stop looking and the record is destroyed, then maybe it returns to an unknown state again.
What will quantum computing do in terms of speed, answering problems? I even, in doing some research, Stan, you know how people try to hack into other people's computers.
Right.
They try to get codes.
Yes.
And under conventional computers, it's possible, but it takes a long time. It's very difficult.
Very expensive. Big computers.
With quantum computers, won't they be able to analyze quickly codes and passwords?
That's the point. If you can't tell if the cat is dead and alive, you can act on it as if it's both simultaneously. Worse, it may be a lot of other things. It may not be a cat. It may be something that can have a lot of different alternate outcomes. A lot of different logical choices can be made in the same circuitry, but they could go this way, could go that way. But the ordinary computer checks everything one step at a time, like the way it does a chess game, or it tries every move in logical sequence. The quantum computer, because of this quality of superposition, can do a million, potentially an unlimited number of calculations, essentially in a New York minute.
Are you saying that a quantum computer will have the capability of reasoning?
Well, we don't know. One of the speculations is that at least part of the way our minds work is based on principles that are similar to those that operate in the quantum computer. So the answer is probably that's going to turn out to be true. I would guess it would be, but I don't think it's been shown. But the point is, what the quantum computer can do is just what you said. It can do multiple simultaneous equations. It can run multiple simultaneous choices, so that instead of factoring a big number into two prime factors by trying every possible prime number and a few tricks, which is what they do now, it could do all of those factors simultaneously, and bingo, there's the answer. The only answer you get is the one. This is going to turn out to be of interest later when we talk about intelligent design and evolution. The only output that you get from the computer, of course, are solutions that actually fly. Others just don't make it through the calculation, or they don't fit the environment, then the output, they're meaningless. So there's a kind of filtering process that takes place. And what you have not only is doing everything simultaneously, but the output is only one or the prime candidates. You're handed the result on a silver platter. And what this means is, and I guess we've done the show in the first 5 minutes here, is that the main argument of the people promoting the necessity for belief in intelligent design rather than random evolutionary steps is the argument that if you were to make the evolutionary steps at random, one at a time, and you do the calculations, then it would take longer than the age of the universe for many things to have actually evolved. Now, there's criticism of that, and we've posted some material on the website. You can get through our websites that backs this up, so there's references that people can go to. But the main argument is that the proponents of intelligent design are doing just what Arthur Clarke said. Arthur Clarke said any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. To propose an intelligent design, a magical solution, you know, bingo, this change to that by some outside choice, is to basically say we don't know how it was done.
Now, truly, how far away might quantum computers be from really being in our lives?
Well, that's hard to say, and no one knows how far the military pushes things without telling us. Publicly has been proof of concept. Demonstrations have been run that prove it can happen. Some of the big problems are, how do you keep the quantum mechanical system isolated from the outside world? Because if you disturb it, then you lose this quantum coherence, you lose the superposition, and it doesn't work. You don't get any result. So the question is, can you keep these systems completely isolated? What kind of systems can you use?
And when you say isolated, does that mean it can't be attached, let's say, to the Internet?
Right. It, not only that, it can't even be probed. Querying it would change it.
So it's got to be basically self-contained, all by itself?
Yeah, which would be useless. What they found more recently is something that we're going to talk about as having been observed in nature, but people haven't noticed this before, at least an analogy, an analog, and that's this idea of a so-called Bose-Einstein condensate, an agglomeration, accumulation of, say, lots of electrons, but they all behave coherently together as if they're one entity. And so they condensed to one state, and they share it. That goes against the original ideas of quantum mechanics that said every electron had to have a separate orbit, had to have a separate state, no two could occupy the same state. Now they discover a kind of laser-like coherence can be held. And now, even more startling, they're actually getting close to room temperature with macroscopic-type systems, which is really becoming impressive. So I'd say maybe they're going to be doing real things in only a few years. How long it takes to harness the technology? Well, they were talking about flat screen TVs
and now they're all over the place.
Yeah, but it depends on what
it took a while.
It
took a while. Now, but how will this affect us, Stan? I mean, you know, most people go through their day-to-day lives. In this particular case, so there's quantum computing, so it comes out. You know, so what? What's going to happen?
It will change our view of reality, because quantum computing does things that shouldn't be possible. You know, it shouldn't, and I'm backing up to Schrodinger's cat, it shouldn't be possible for the cat to be dead to one person, and then that person passes away, and there's no record, and the cat doesn't do anything in the entering moment, so there's no physical record any place, and the next guy checks, and the cat's alive. That goes against common sense.
True, that should not happen.
Well, to a Newtonian, linear, childlike reality. But we see how young children and many even fairly intelligent animals are easily fooled by simple logical and geometric and optical tricks. And we may be being fooled in a similar sense to think the world is more substantial, more mechanical, more cause and effect than it really is. A lot of the devices we're using now depend on quantum mechanical effects. So we know that there's a reality at some level. What's happening slowly is what used to be very esoteric. Oh, it's only microscopic Planck scale. Oh, only very electrons, one at a time. We're now seeing macroscopic effects. They're now bringing it into the real world. I don't know how long these things take. A lot depends on how much. I'll tell you exactly how long it takes. I learned this at MIT. I was sitting in a class. This is very subversive. I was sitting in a class on this was psychology or politics, run by Carl Oglesby.
All right, hold that right there, Stan, and we'll finish up with you when we come right back. Stan's website's linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. You know, the first computer was designed by German engineer Konrad Zuse in 1941. I bet he would be amazed at how it's come along. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Let's get this week off to a resounding start for Al Bielek. You know, he is the person who put together that Philadelphia experiment story for us. He was part of it many years ago, an incredible story that it is. Art interviewed him. Art believes it was one of his classic interviews. We're going to give you that CD, that show, for free. There is shipping and handling, so that's only a few bucks. When you subscribe to the After Dark newsletter, so you call 1-888-727-5505, or you can go to coasttocoastam.com. Now, all that's well and good, but more importantly, we have decided to give a portion of those proceeds to Al Bielek. He's come on some tough financial times right now, and so as you buy them, we're going to be putting together the proceeds and sending a portion to Al Bielek, and I think it will help him dramatically based on some of our projections. So you get the free CD of Art Bell's interview with Al Bielek, you get the After Dark subscription, and he gets some donation money. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Stan Tenen, our guest tonight. Stan, let's pick up your story here.
Actually, this ties into something that caught my attention when you opened the show with the news report about what happened in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
And, you know, all you can say is that you're humbled by it, and we're all grateful that we're alive and we see how fragile life is. And the question is, you know, how did this happen and when does it get fixed? You just asked me, when are we going to have the benefits of quantum computing?
Yes.
And it reminded me of an incident in the 60s. I went to Brooklyn Polytech. I didn't go to MIT, but the schools were kind of open at that point, and Carl Oglesby was a leader of, I think, Students for Democratic Society, a very radical guy. I'm sure he was being watched. And I sat in a class, and he put up on the blackboard a chart where it was just a simple, you know, line drawing. He drew a vertical axis and a horizontal axis, and on the vertical axis he wrote dollars spent. And on the horizontal axis, he wrote number of elementary particles discovered. And on the chart, he wrote a diagonal line coming up from the origin, just straight up. The more money spent, the more elementary particles were going to be discovered. Because the idea is, the bigger the cyclic, the bigger the atom smasher, the greater number of little parts you get. As a general rule, the same is true with repairing the infrastructure or any number of other things. What I'm looking for are these general rules, and I'm saying that these are the same kinds of things that people would be looking for in other star systems or in the ancient world, that searching for rules to live by, both to, you know, little personal things, some recipes for cooking bread or something, and also rules for making money on the stock market or running the United Nations, running a government, a bicameral United States. We all look for this because it helps us to live better.
But in a quantum computing world, aren't the rules thrown out?
No. Quantum computers are just as logical as regular computers. They just make use of more of reality than Newton was aware of.
They don't give you alternatives?
Well, they can. It depends on what you want to do, and it depends on how you set it up. I since nobody has really done this yet, a lot depends on what they decide.
Well, let's use the bridge as an example. You know, 40 years ago when this thing was built, I'm not sure they had the kind of computer models available to ascertain how to build that thing. So I think they had to rely on...
Well, actually, they switched the building codes between 1967 and 1968.
And that had a lot to do with
it. They required redundancy.
Okay, but let's say today they design a new bridge and we have quantum computing to do it. We don't, but let's say we did.
If we wanted to spend the time and energy, if we thought it was cost effective to be this optimal, you could do a better, finer, more accurate range of surveys of possible designs and alternatives, and in much greater detail using a quantum computer than it would ever be worth taking the time and effort to do on a conventional.
Sure. I mean, would that...
But it still might not be worth doing in that case.
Well, if it saves a life, isn't it?
Well, it might be a lot, yes, but there are other ways to save lives that are more cost-effective. But quantum computing principles are principles of perhaps the way our minds work. They can give us insight into technologies and into ways of doing things and seeing things that are not just scaled up, bigger, better machines, but are radically, as radically different than the world was before the internet and it is now.
But would a quantum computer, let's say the estimate is 150,000 cars a day would go through this, okay, on this bridge. Would a quantum computer, if you put in 300,000 cars a day, would this computer then show you how to build this bridge where nothing could topple it?
No, you wouldn't need to do it. You could guarantee that using conventional techniques a lot less expensively.
You could,
There'd be no need to go to that level. A bridge is a simple mechanical device. We have more than adequate means of modeling it every which way. The real problem is when the tax rate doesn't support doing the job as well as everyone would like.
Yes.
And they don't get the insulation fixed on the shuttle, and you know what happens.
And that's the real problem, Stan.
Problem is the let me tell you what the problem is. It's both. It's a mixed blessing. As society gets wiser, as we all learn more about our own specialties, even though we haven't gotten any stupider, relative to all the other specialties, we're less qualified than we used to be. We're more isolated in what we do well, and no less than what a brain surgeon does. Back when brain surgeons were also, you know, barbers or dentists, we all knew what a brain surgeon did. But we don't know that anymore because brain surgery has become a lot more refined.
Of course, then again, some of the ancients that you and I have talked about on a past program, some of them were pretty good brain surgeons years ago.
Well, I don't know. in primitive things, relieving pressure maybe. although they did do one thing.
See?
They were able, now, even though the patient may not have lived, and even though this is kind of gruesome and all that, the brain is not sensitive to touch internally, but you can probe and stimulate it, and you would be able to map the so-called homunculus on the brain. And so you would know how, for example, the cortex for the hand occupies a major part of the side of the brain and is related to the cortex that controls speech. And you would, even in the ancient world, using primitive techniques, again, you know, sorry, the patients probably didn't make it, you would be able to learn these neuroanatomical connections. So it wouldn't be, it doesn't require a modern world to have this kind of knowledge. And that's what I'm claiming some of what I'm finding in our traditional teachings is based on a much more sophisticated level of understanding, but drawn from techniques and using methods and means that were available. You know where we see quantum computers all the time?
Right.
Every time. You can look out a window. Where are you going to see a quantum computer?
Where?
You see a flock of birds, a swarm of bees, and if you happen to have a pond, you might see a school of fish.
Explain that.
Well, the flock makes simultaneous calculations, doesn't it?
Well, it's all over the place.
Well, but
it's left, it's right.
It's not the computer. It's the space in which the computer can happen. It's the Bose-Einstein condensate. It's the agglomeration of a large number that act as a single unit. And so the school moves as a school. The flock moves as a flock. The swarm moves as a swarm. And in the case of the swarm, the honeybee's waggle dance actually recapitulates the geometry at the beginning of Genesis, and we know the Egyptians and the ancients had mastery of beekeeping and et cetera. So we could even talk about how they knew all of that.
Well, how do we know, though, they're not communicating with each other through this, conscious world that we're in?
Well, yes. But what does it consist of? There's recently published research into how swarming behavior takes place, which is astonishing and simple and elegant. Let me give you the
all right.
We've got links to this and pieces of the articles up on the website that we put together to back the show up.
And that's meru.org, that one?
Through meru.org, meru.org, and that'll get you to also the meeting10.com and to the website for the material that we put together.
Okay.
And the special deals and all that.
Okay.
Anyway, the three stages of swarming behavior, as has recently been published, and I'm just going to barely outline it. First, you have just a random mess of say, bees. Bees not maybe too good an example because they do better than most insects.
And they're disappearing. Sadly.
You should do a show on that.
We have.
I should listen.
I agree. Well, you do once in a while.
Look, I'm on the East Coast. These are rough hours for me. And the town wakes me up at 5 in the morning, even next to a nature preserve these days. Don't get me going.
We broke the bee story a long time ago.
Really?
The disappearing honeybees.
Yeah.
But that's another.
Well, do you know the waggle dance that the bees make is the same model as is outlined in the first verse of Genesis?
One more time?
The waggle dance. It's actually up on our website. There's a graphic. The waggle dance. The bees dance on their honeycomb.
Yes.
To indicate where the flowers are for the other bees.
Right. They're communicating with
right.
each other.
Well,
okay.
If you look at the dance, it's basically a wiggle, wiggle, wiggle. Then they run around to the back, and they go wiggle, wiggle, wiggle. And then they run around the other direction to the back, and they keep like this figure eight thing. They keep doing it.
Yes.
With the figure eight part, the bar in the middle pointing towards the food. And the angle is compared to the sun. Well, the model in Genesis is exactly the same model, except instead of two lobes, it's got three lobes because it's in 3D instead of 2D.
And what
otherwise, it's exactly the same model. You can actually see it.
Well, what does that tell you?
It tells me that what I'm proposing about the hand gestures generating the Hebrew and later the Greek and Arabic letters is something they could have known about. Both the neurophysiology, they would have known the homunculus and how the hand maps onto the brain. They would have known from beekeeping the behavior of the bees and how they conveyed information by pointing and using a kind of dance, a gesture to do it. And they also would have had to know about using bellows, because the way you tame bees is with smoke, and bellows make smoke rings, and that's exactly also the same geometry as the waggle dance itself.
It sounds like you're scratching the surface of intended design.
I'm scratching the surface of not needing intended design, of doing something even more astounding. I'm saying that now this is what's happened in the last year and a half since we last did the show.
All right, what?
The Meru Project itself, after 40 years basically, has come full circle. I laid down a set of criteria that I needed to meet when we first formed Meru Foundation. That was like 1986. And among those criteria was that if there was some meaning to the sequence of letters at the beginning of Genesis, it had to, and given the claims made for the text, it had to meet the von Neumann challenge. It had to meet the conditions of a living information system, and we found that. But it also had to do something else. I never went to a yeshiva. I don't speak Hebrew. I can't read Hebrew or Aramaic or Arabic. I grew up in Brooklyn. I went to James Madison High School. I was on the math team. I learned pattern recognition. What else did I? I didn't learn anything else. When I looked at the letters, I put together these patterns from nothing but the raw text. I could read translations of all these mystical literature, but none of it makes sense. You know, give me a break, people. Buy the latest translation of Sefer Yetzirah. You tell me what you think it means. I'm telling you, I think the geometry in Genesis is what it means, and I think we cracked it. But I didn't know that at the time. It didn't make sense to me. So I started from scratch. Therefore, since I couldn't read the rabbinic text or the Talmudic text or even Christian or Muslim or anything else but simple English stuff, I had to wait until we moved east and started working with people who had a background that could read rabbinic and Talmudic material and the original Kabbalistic text. And in the last year, they've come to me with quotations from traditional sources that verify that the geometries we pulled out of Genesis were known to the rabbis and the Christians and the Muslims until about 200 years ago, when apparently Napoleon pretty much killed everyone who knew.
And we lost that knowledge.
Well,
somehow.
The point is that this was all known. It was known because of beekeeping, because you need a bellows to smell the bronze and iron, and you get smoke rings when you have a bellows, and so you have a real cosmological real cosmology. The way a smoke ring works by falling through itself is the topology of the Big Bang of creation in everybody's book, modern and ancient. So they would have had an experimental medium for understanding self-referential creation, something falling through itself. Now, we've got verification from these rabbinic texts, but we also found something else. They've had several thousand years to work on this stuff. I've only had 30 years or 40 years. So there was a lot for me to learn in the last year.
So
the concept of the Shefa Tal, which is foolishly translate to get this. Tell me what this means. Effulgence of dew.
I have.
Does anybody in the world know what effulgence of dew means?
I have no idea.
Who wrote it?
I don't know what it is.
Well, I'll tell you what it is. It means something that Roger Penrose, the physicist, wrote about, and he also talks about quantum computing, in his most recent books, The Road to Reality and The Emperor's New Mind, the one before it. It talks about it in relation to the source of the organizing information that plant life needs. And this is Penrose. Penrose points out that it's the contrast, the gradient, between the white light photons from the sun, which are collimated, which carry high information, mm-hmm. high neg entropy, and the infrared photons that the Earth radiates back to the sky, in that negentropic gradient, in that information stream, like drops of dew, except they're photons, the plants absorb this information, and they use it to organize and become alive. And the rabbis, quoting from traditional sources, going back to the Hebrew Bible, as recently as 200 years ago, say exactly what Roger Penrose says. And that gives us the same geometry and the same model, except the rabbis are not talking about physical photons. They're talking about units of information in general, but not things, but the relationship behind the thing. It's the same idea. The word tall, one of the things we've done by recovering the alphabet is recovering the operational hieroglyphic, if you will, meaning of each letter. Tal is spelled tet lamed. Tet means to bind all into one thing. And lamed means learning, abstraction. A tal, which is translated as dew, like a dewdrop, is actually a unit of information. And in a hyperdimensional sense, a transcendental sense, a spiritual sense, I don't know what you want to call it, but it's not mechanical. We stand in this continuous drain, spread, flow of these units of negentropy from a transcendent source in exactly the same way, metaphorically, comparably, to the way the plants stand in this flow of negentropy between the sun and the sky.
Well, yeah, but how can you say then that there is no intended design?
Because what's provided to us, this is the beauty part, is the potential to make choices. We get to make the choices because we're the ones who break the quantum mechanical superposition.
Maybe we were designed to make the choices.
Ultimately, once you posit a beginning to the universe, you can always take every cause to it by definition. But the way the Western traditions are organized is that the story of the Garden of Eden is telling us that we get to make the choices and live by the choices we make. If you want to know how we find ourselves in the particular universe we're in, is there going to be an Armageddon or is there going to be peace?
We don't know, but it could go either way.
But wouldn't it be nice if we could have some input into what we experience? Let me tell you a fantastic, sad, and powerful story. I was called the other day by a very well-intended evangelical Christian minister. He really wanted me to have the love of Jesus. I'm Jewish, obviously. It didn't work. he didn't understand what happened during the Holocaust. He said that unless I accepted Jesus, I wouldn't be raptured.
Oh, come on.
Now, we know about the Holocaust, get this, not from the perspective of the people who died, not from the perspective of Schrodinger's cat, the cat. We know the Holocaust from the perspective of the survivors who went through the misery of coming within an inch of being annihilated.
Yep.
And all the fear. So maybe this Christian minister, in all his well intention, it isn't necessary for the Jewish path to go through Jesus. Maybe Jews who believe, who say the Shema, who keep the Shabbos, who keep kosher, go directly, are raptured when they leave automatically.
Stay
and
with us, Stan.
The same is true for Muslims who really submit to Allah.
All right. Stay with us, Stan. We're at the top of the hour. We'll be right back.